I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
Submitted for your approval, one Peter Campbell, a man who recently discovered that the only place for his hand is in your pocket. You watch it. Have you seen it, The Twilight Zone?
I don't think so. I don't like science fiction.
I'm going to pretend you didn't say that.
We're back again with creator and executive producer of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner, right here on the TV Time Machine. Matt, how has The Twilight Zone influenced the style, look, or creative emphasis of the series?
Well, I'm a big fan of The Twilight Zone, and I'm a big fan of Rod Serling and of this period in television writing. And one of the things that's interesting is Rod Serling was not someone to shy away from polemics or from political statements, and he had tremendous credibility having been a decorated veteran and coming in and writing, and whether his politics are considered left-wing or whatever, he wrote a movie of the week that was about a lynching. And after it went through the process of the networks, it ended up taking place in Mexico in the 1880s, and he was so disgusted with it that he started doing that. This is the impression I got from his biography, that he did The Twilight Zone. And when he was interviewed about it, there's a famous interview with him with Mike Wallace, and he said, "Oh, I'm just doing fantasy, and I just want to, you know, just entertain people, and it's a, you know, science fiction. Basically, it's for kids. It's not meaningful." And of course, The Twilight Zone is one of the most socially conscious and like stinging indictments of our culture that's ever been made. And I always wanted to have that kind of integrity in the show, but I also wanted to do a show that was not an imitation of the pieces of that period. And when the show first came out, there was a lot of talk about the Cirque and about The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, and I kept saying, no, I'm not doing that. This is about the people that watched those things. And the way I see it is that for those shows to be commercially successful in that period, and they were, those movies and shows, it meant that that was on the mind of the culture. And not that Rod Serling is a leader, not a leader intellectually, but that he is tapping on a vein of discontent and of irony and of subversion that is part of the culture at that time and always part of the American culture. So when we met Paul, the copywriter, it made perfect sense to me that that show was on the air and that that show was very important. And I wanted to keep that in mind, that that was going on at that time. The same way that you see Betty reading Ship of Fools or whatever. These books and movies and television shows have tremendous irony in the show, but they were there's nothing in there that was not a gigantic commercial success, and which means that it was on people's minds. So it's kind of a full circle thing. I was inspired by it. And then I wanted to make it part of that world, but I wanted to make it part of that world as something that people are consuming, not as, and you know, and also people imitate those things. They really do. Those are attitudes that become, you know, metabolized by individuals. So, you know, any comparison to it is flattering to me. I'm in awe of the work that he did and the amount of it and the depth of it. And there's some duds and clinkers in there like anything he's doing. Whatever, 39 shows a year or something.
Mean the Brain Center at Whipple's wasn't brilliant?
But well, I love the fact that they were always about something, and it is my goal when I do an episode of the show that it be about something, no matter what else is going on in it, that it is about something that's beyond the continuing storyline.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing I really appreciate about Mad Men is it really is a throwback to the way television was back in the 50s and early 60s, where especially Serling scripts, which were dialogue-driven, character-driven, instead of driven by action and gore and violence and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, you know, this is a weird thing about writing and about television in particular, because television is this hybrid of theater and film. Mm. And people are coming out of radio, and it's all dialogue-driven,
right.
And there are atmosphere and sound effects and things like that. But on television, you have a chance to really show things. And whatever their budget was or anything on The Twilight Zone, you do get to see that carousel. You get to see that boy limping off. You get to see Gig Young's wallet. You get to see the posters on the wall. And that's all cinema, whether it's violence or not. Those are the moments that really, really are absorbed by the audience. Those are the payoffs. And they cost more money to shoot because it's one line in the script, and it's, at the same time, it's a whole scene. So it's not a lot of page count. It doesn't cost a lot of ink, but it costs a lot of film and a lot of production. And I always loved the fact that in the midst of all of these speechifying and talk and conflict of dialogue, there are private moments that provide irony. You know, just seeing someone's apartment, just seeing how they live. Those things are all thought of, and those are all written into the script. That's not just like, give me an apartment for a guy like that. It's literally like, he opens the fridge and there's nothing in it, and well, there you go, you know.
Right, or he opens the drawer and he's got a stack of shirts inside.
Exactly, and directors are extremely resistant to that because they don't like editing. They try and do everything mise-en-scene. It's, everything has to be in one shot.
But that gesture tells, you know, volumes about the character. And
Exactly. And it's action. It's as much action as someone being punched in the face to see Don open that drawer and see that not only is he changing in his office, but he does it all the time.
Right. And the attention to detail.
He doesn't go home a lot.
The attention to detail in the show, I think, is one of the things, whether people realize it on a conscious level or not, is one of the things about the show that makes it really special. And one of the best things I find is that even the so-called, what other people might call minor characters, like you mentioned, you know, the guy who loves the Twilight Zone, have a real story. You really get the feeling that the people who are writing about them know who they are. Is this just a sleight of hand?
I do. I know who they are. They're based on real people or amalgamations of real people or facets of myself that I hate or love. And it's this thing about it's too hard to do drama and just keep someone in the same and never really go behind the scenes on them. And I wanted to have a show, and this is definitely related to The Sopranos, where you could follow any character home. And depending on casting and on how much you know about them, a desire to know about them would fuel you, and you get to see something surprising, or you get to see, you know, dramatic irony, I think is the technical term for it, but it's basically where the audience knows something that the other characters don't. That is very entertaining to me. And whenever we can see someone go in and... you know, behave one way and then find out that they're very different, it's fantastic, you know. Mm-hmm. Peggy on her blind date, you know, knowing where she's coming from and hearing this guy talk. And at the same time, they surprise you because a lot of times they behave in the way they do at the office, and we still know that there's something different about how they really feel, or that that their feelings are hurt because someone has insulted them that day, not because of what's going on in that moment.
Right.
So I want those minor characters to be as substantial as possible, and it also keeps you from exhausting the depth of your main characters. You're not doing it the same thing every week.
Mm.
And it's tempting to do the same thing every week, and it's easier, but it gets very boring very quickly, and you end up in a sort of dead place in the story. And that's why you don't see even other than Don, and even Don drops out to some degree in some episodes, you really don't spend time with the same people every week. I always try and mix that up story-wise, and that was very unsettling for the network and the studio, you know, that the second episode, Pete Campbell, who makes this incredible impression in the pilot, is just not in the episode. He's talked about constantly, which I thought was even better, and he's on his honeymoon, but I wanted the audience to say, like, we never know whose story we're going to tell or where we're going to be.
Right.
Well, you mentioned Peggy, and one thing that's clearly changed over the years is women's opportunities in the business world.
Right.
Now, your show addresses that issue, really, through the character of Peggy, once a secretary, as we'll hear in the following clip.
I don't understand. They want me to write something?
Whatever you said in that brainstorming session apparently knocked their socks off.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know what to say.
You will, of course, continue to cover Mr. Draper's desk. Any writing you do will be on your own time.
Do I get a raise?
No. Congratulations. More work and more responsibility. I guess you'll be entitled to some dinner money.
Maybe I should go and thank them?
I'm not really dressed.
Tomorrow, maybe?
No need. They wanted me to tell you. They were very specific about it. Well, you know what they say. The medium is the message.
I really like that reference there to Marshall McLuhan. That's
yeah, funny. I don't know if he's said it yet. There's some discussion about how it had not even been said yet. But and he certainly hadn't said the medium is the massage yet.
Right, exactly.
but what I really wanted to say is, and this is true, is that they had given her more responsibility and they were going to utilize her, which they did all the time, especially with what they consider to be women's products. Women then as now are 75% of the buying market. And they are not involved at all. We're not involved. They're involved very little in the construction of sales strategies. And it was important that she was being given more responsibility and being given basically a promotion, but that promotion would not come from the bosses. They would not even dignify her with bringing her in and telling her that. They just had the head of the secretarial pool tell her that she's going to have some extra work.
But that was such a great, to me, that as a woman having started as a copywriter in advertising, and it was 20 years later than this story, it's such a great depiction between the conflict of different kinds of ways to be a woman in
right.
this office. And Peggy's really a pioneer. Without meaning to be, because being taken seriously for her mind instead of for her body, which is how, you were supposed to get by before that.
Well, her goals are different, and it was important to me that Joan is never envious of her. Joan is confused by the fact that she would want this.
Yeah.
This is not, and that was derived. First of all, I just told you about my mother. Going back to school, and my mother is a super intelligent person with a very substantial education, but there was I had the experience. I was interested in the men, and by that I mean myself. And then I read Sex and the Single Girl and The Feminine Mystique, which I was supposed to read in college, but really had just taken classes on it and never read it. I read those in a week, and in the same time period, and I ripped through both of them. They're both exquisitely written. I think it's known that Betty Friedan's a great writer, but I don't know if Helen Gurley Brown really gets her due as being such an incredible stylist and such an entertaining writer. But they are so, so in conflict with each other. They're such incredibly distant messages from each other.
Matt, one of the aspects of your show is going to be addressed here by Mr. Serling in the following clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Here's something that doesn't require any imagination. It's Oasis. If you just took this puff, you'd agree. It's the softest taste of all. Before we meet again, try Oasis for the softest taste of all.
Advertising is based on one thing, happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay. You are okay.
Now, the fact is, back in the 1960s, people smoked, and they smoked a lot. Have you been surprised by the reaction of people now regarding this element of your series?
I was shocked that people were so, first of all, culturally in denial about its existence, when it really didn't disappear until the 90s, in the workplace anyway. And there's a real kind of moral superiority about it, when it was really a habit as common as eating. So that has shocked me, but it's I wanted it there for the same reason that the reason it was in the pilot is because it was such a great irony.
Well, Matt, it's been a tremendous pleasure having you aboard the TV Time Machine. Feel free to join us again in the future or in the past.
This is Jim Benson. Join us again next time as our magical transport takes us on yet another journey exploring television's past, present, and future. You'll find your next adventure right here on the TV Time Machine.